Martin, David Egan, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Yes, Diane Yandach, Y-A-N-D-A-C-H, representing the Office of Attorney Ethics.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Patrick Minter with Donnelly, Minter & Kelly, representing the respondent, Mr. Egan.
Is Mr. Egan present with you?
Yes, Your Honor. Present with me is Mr. Egan, and also present with me is John Whipple, who was Mr. Egan's criminal defense counsel, who's just here, obviously not to speak.
Mr. Egan, you'll have the opportunity to address the court if you'd like, and you can have a moment or two with counsel when we reach that point to discuss whether you'd like to speak to the court. You need not. You need not. It's not obligatory. Ms. Yandach.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Associate Justices. May it please the court. This matter concerns the Office of Attorney Ethics' motion for final discipline after respondent pled guilty to conspiracy to commit bank fraud in violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1349. Respondent's conduct constitutes knowing misappropriation and is in violation of RPC's 8.4B regarding engaging in a criminal act, 8.4C regarding dishonesty, and 1.15A, again, regarding knowing misappropriation under the principles of In re Wilson and In re Hollandonner. The facts of this case will establish that respondent conspired with some home repair contractors to defraud multiple mortgage lenders and vulnerable homeowners. The conspiracy started when the contractors found homeowners who wished to have repairs done or renovations on their home, and those contractors suggested they could finance the work using reverse mortgages. The reverse mortgages were available through an FHA program to older homeowners in order to convert the equity in their home to cash. Respondent acted as a settlement agent for those reverse mortgages. Respondent admitted that he knew or should have known that the homeowners were vulnerable. Respondent's actions in the conspiracy included creating two versions of the HUD-1 statements for each transaction. First, he submitted a false HUD-1 statement to the lenders indicating that the loan proceeds would be dispersed to the homeowners. He signed the certification stating that the HUD-1 was true and correct, and then he later admitted that he falsified the HUD-1 with the purpose to deceive the lenders. He then gave a second HUD-1 to the homeowners indicating that the loan proceeds would be dispersed directly to the contractors. He then knowingly and intentionally dispersed the loan proceeds directly to the contractors, his co-conspirators. While respondent was well aware that had the lenders known that he would be dispersing the funds to the contractors, that they would not have approved the loan or given him the funds. Respondent pled guilty to conspiring with the contractors to defraud the lenders, and that guilty plea is conclusive evidence in this ethics case. Respondent admitted during his plea hearing that the purpose of submitting the false HUD-1 statements was to deceive the lenders that he had dispersed the full amount of the loan proceeds to the homeowners. Respondent further admitted that his actions played a significant role in the conspiracy and allowed the contractors to further defraud the at least 10 homeowners of a total of $578,000. While respondent claims that he had no knowledge of the contractor's intent to further defraud the homeowners by failing to complete the renovations, his experience as a real estate attorney, his knowledge that the contractors intended to defraud the lenders, and the vulnerability of the homeowners should have raised red flags with the respondent, and he should have been aware of the highly likelihood that the homeowners would be defrauded as well.
How do you reconcile all of that with the district court judge in federal court in this case, who I thought said on the record, quote, he had no idea that there was a scheme to steal these funds from these vulnerable elderly homeowners. I find that when he learned of that scheme, he immediately cooperated without an agreement with the United States because I believe he thought it was the right thing to do.
So yes, those were Judge Qureshi's findings. That is on the record. And that is true. However, I think when you look at the underlying facts, you know, respondent was a very well experienced real estate attorney, and I think there were several red flags here. The purpose, you know, the lender's purpose in insisting that the funds be dispersed to the homeowners is to avoid this type of fraud. And so I think just based on, you know, Mr. Egan's experience as a real estate attorney, his knowledge that the contractors were obviously not good people because they intended to defraud the lenders, I think those just raise red flags that respondent.
So Are you disagreeing with Judge Karashi's explicit finding that, quote, he had no idea that there was a scheme to steal these funds from these vulnerable elderly homeowners?
I think the court should consider the red flags and acknowledge that respondent is an experienced real estate attorney and that there were red flags there that at least respondent should have been aware and should have recognized. Whether he actually did or not, you know, obviously it's Judge Qureshi's finding that he did not recognize the red flags. The OAE's position is that he should have recognized those red flags given his experience and his knowledge of the contractor's intent and his own intent to defraud the lenders. So respondent's actions here, as he admitted in the plea hearing, constitute knowing misappropriation under Hollandonner. One, he accepted the funds and held them in escrow for the benefit of both the lenders and the homeowners. And two, he knowingly dispersed those escrow funds to the contractors, knowing that he did not have the permission of the lenders to do so. Those are the simple facts here that are analogous to Hollandonner and establish knowing misappropriation of escrow funds. And the quantum of discipline for knowing misappropriation is disbarment, regardless of any mitigating factors. Respondent claims that he should not be disbarred because he was not on notice that his conduct would result in disbarment. However, respondent's conduct, again, is analogous to Hollandonner. Therefore, he was on notice back when Hollandonner was decided in 1985 that knowingly misappropriating and dispersing escrow funds without the permission of both parties is knowing misappropriation, and disbarment is the level of discipline. To make matters worse, Mr. Egan here engaged in a course of conduct over 2 to 3 years in which at least 10 homeowners were defrauded of over $500,000. Mr. Egan knew or should have known that the homeowners were vulnerable and they placed their trust in him, and he abused that trust. Mr. Egan easily could have insisted that the loan proceeds be dispersed to the homeowners, who could have immediately turned them over to the contractors themselves. However, he chose not to go that route. Instead, he chose to engage in a conspiracy and defraud the lenders. The facts here are distinguishable from cases like Soriano. In Soriano, there was no criminal conviction for fraud that conclusively established that knowing element of knowing misappropriation. There was only a single instance of falsifying a HUD-1 statement, and there were no vulnerable victims. The vulnerable victims is an important point for the court to keep in mind. The court addressed vulnerability in In Re Torre, where the court ordered a higher level of discipline than either the OAE or the board had recommended. And that was because conduct in that case resulted in substantial harm to vulnerable elderly victim. Here as well, Mr. Egan's conduct involved in the conspiracy resulted in substantial harm to at least 10 older vulnerable homeowners. Furthermore, Mr. Egan's conduct eroded the principal reason for discipline and the disciplinary system to preserve the confidence of the public in the integrity and trustworthiness of lawyers in general. In conclusion, respondent's conduct here in dispersing escrow funds to his co-conspirators, in direct contrast to their instructions, the lender's instructions, constitutes knowing misappropriation of escrow funds under Hollandonner, and therefore the OAE agrees with the board's unanimous decision and recommendation that respondent be disbarred.
How do you respond to respondent's argument that you are now attempting to link this back to Hollandonner, but you did not attempt to link this back to Hollandonner at the time that you originally brought the charge, and even the DRB admitted, quote, in our 2021 decision in hand, we modified our view of similar fact patterns involving attorneys who, comma, while serving as escrow agents, comma, knowingly dispersed funds in violation of a lender's closing instructions. That makes it seem like hand was a new rule and not one that automatically someone would have understood came from Hollandonner.
So I think there's two questions there. First, admittedly, the OAE did initially file a motion for final discipline recommending Mr. Egan be suspended. To be frank, that motion was a mistake. The OAE should have argued knowing misappropriation from the beginning. When the board remanded the matter back to the OAE, the office, you know, reevaluated and found clear and convincing evidence of knowing misappropriation under Holland Donner. To address the second part of your question regarding Hand, I think the board addressed that in both their decision in Hand, this argument of new law, as well as its decision in this case. So the conduct in Hand was not new law. It was simply a different application or a rethinking of the application of Holland Donner. And to be honest, there are many similarities with Hand, and there are some differences as well. So in Hand, the underlying transaction was a little bit different in Hand and Nahaman, if you'd like me to address that one. The conduct was that the respondent failed to collect a deposit from the buyer in the transaction, whereas here, the underlying transaction was a little bit different in that Mr. Egan failed to disperse the funds to the homeowners, a party to the escrow, and instead dispersed those funds to the contractors who were not a party to the escrow agreement. And in the Hand and Nahaman decisions, there were not vulnerable victims involved in those cases. But to be clear, both the OAE and the board's current position is that both Hand and Nahaman were knowing misappropriation.
Other questions, anyone? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Minter.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, and good afternoon, Associate Justices. May it please the court. Mr. Chief Justice, my client would like to take the opportunity, and we would request leave of court for him to have an opportunity to address a short statement after the conclusion of the oral arguments.
Of course.
The stakes here could not be higher for my client, as this matter comes before the court following a recommendation from the DRB for disbarment. And as has been addressed, the DRB's recommendation for disbarment here is grounded in the court's 1985 decision in Inri Holland Donner, which represented an extension of the Wilson Doctrine when applied to the handling of escrowed funds. But respectfully, and I think it's really the thread of our arguments here, the court's decision in Holland Donner historically has never been applied as a bright line rule in the manner that Wilson has. The conduct in this matter occurred between 2007 and 2010. And despite the more recent pronouncements from the DRB, it's simply a fact that conduct precisely like that which occurred here was not viewed by either the DRB or the court as a disbarrable offense at that time. It's an oft-quoted maxim, and I believe my colleague already quoted it, that the central purpose of our attorney discipline system is not to punish the attorneys, but rather to protect the public and preserve public confidence in the bar. But shouldn't some semblance of this construct also apply to protect the members of the bar as well? Isn't the bar entitled to enjoy confidence that the disciplinary system will be consistent in its treatment of attorney respondents, particularly when we're talking about the ultimate sanction of disbarment? And in this case, it's respectfully submitted that Mr. Egan's conduct, which again occurred here between 2007 and 2010, does not warrant permanent disbarment 15 years later. Rather, consistent with the contemporaneous precedent at the time, we would submit and ask the court to impose discipline of a retroactive suspension of 2 years, particularly given the overwhelming and uncontroverted mitigating factors that exist here. I'd like to just address some of the facts that I think are important, particularly in light of the opening from the Office of Attorney Ethics. Just in general, since 2002, Mr. Egan owned and operated a law firm in Morristown, and it focused nearly exclusively, on residential real estate transactions. The conduct here involved transactions, 10 of them, that occurred between 2007 and 2010, when Mr. Egan acted as a settlement agent for home equity conversion loans. They're commonly called reverse mortgages. And in the transactions at issue, Mr. Egan's office was advised that a portion of the loan proceeds was to be utilized for home renovations to be performed by two contractors, Philip Puccio and Rafael Peralta. And accordingly, Mr. Egan agreed improperly, no question about it, to release a portion of the loan proceeds directly to the contractors to fund those renovations. The homeowner signed off on these disbursements to the contractors on one of the HUD ones, and the second HUD one, the one that was false, was presented to the lender, and it did not show those payments to the contractors. And although the lender, or the lenders, I should say, received their bargain for first lien position, the submission of the false HUD one statements to those lenders formed the basis of his conviction in federal court. But there's a couple of key facts, and I think they're very important given the OAE's presentation here today that I want to stress. First of all, the record is clear. The homeowners were aware of the disbursements to the contractors, and they signed off on them on one of those HUDs. The record's also clear, and Justice Wiener after referred to it, that the district court judge made a finding of fact that Mr. Egan had no knowledge or participation in the actual conspiracy. And it goes further than that. And by the way, that's not to suggest that Mr. Egan didn't know that he submitted a false HUD to the bank. He did. But what he didn't know is that Puccio and Peralta were working with a crooked appraiser to artificially exaggerate the home values with inflated appraisals and false loan applications. He did not know about the larger conspiracy here. And the federal judge, Judge Karashi, made a finding of fact that was alluded to previously, that he had no idea that there was a scheme to steal these funds from these vulnerable elderly homeowners. And by the way, also not mentioned, consistent with the fact that he had no idea about the larger conspiracy, he didn't reap any benefit or in the form of a profit from the conspiracy. He couldn't have because he didn't know about it. What he received was his standard rate in the 10 closings, amounting to cumulatively over about $11,600, which has been returned. So I don't raise any of these points factually to in any way minimize the serious misconduct that occurred here. I want to be very clear on that point. Mr. Egan takes full responsibility for his actions, and he's devastated by the knowledge that his role as an attorney in these transactions cause harm to the innocent people. Those are all words. I think what the court really should look at here is what was his conduct, not his words or mind, but what was his conduct when he learned of this conspiracy? And the reality is he set out to make things right. And the first thing he did, one of the first things he did, is he hired John Whipple, who's over my shoulder here, who's an experienced criminal defense attorney, to advise him and guide him through the process of cooperation with the United States Attorney's Office. And he did so without an agreement. And he did it initially because he believed it was morally the right thing to do, period. And again, Judge Karashi, on a full record, a record that the Office of Attorney Ethics is bound by in this case, made a specific finding to that effect, saying, I find, I'm quoting, when he learned of the scheme, he immediately cooperated without an agreement with the United States because I believe he thought it was the right thing to do. Not because he thought there would be some benefit to himself down the road because one day he may have to face this court. And again, the undisputed facts are that that cooperation that Mr. Egan gave was both extensive and critical. He sat for multiple interviews, proffers, he provided emails, bank records, settlement statements. And as the record here shows, the United States attorney assigned to the criminal case advised the United States District Court that, quote, it would have been extremely difficult, if not impossible, end quote, for the government to have made its case against Puccio and Peralta without Mr. Egan's cooperation. So ultimately, Mr. Egan pled guilty to a one count of conspiracy to commit bank fraud, and he was sentenced as follows. He got time served, which was a single day of processing, 1 year of supervised release, forfeiture of attorney's fees, and again, importantly, and I haven't mentioned this yet, Although he didn't profit from the conspiracy, he paid restitution at sentencing of $355,424.13. Some of the facts of the ethics proceeding.
May I ask?
Yes.
Please. What was the factual basis that he gave to Judge Karashi on the conspiracy charge?
I believe, just to summarize it, Your Honor, it was that he knowingly provided a false HUD-1 statement to the bank, knowing that the bank would rely upon it in its disbursement of the loan proceeds.
And counsel, if I can just ask, what did that 350,000 plus figure represent?
There was a restitution order, I believe, Your Honor, and that figure represented a portion of the restitution order. He made a lump sum payment, I believe, on the day that he was sentenced. And then he has been making periodic, albeit small, payments towards that order since then as well. So the number's actually higher than that, but
we've been there's a figure of $578,937, which represents a joint and several liability restitution amount to all the co-conspirators.
Yeah, that sounds correct, and he paid the 355 of that up front.
And is that in addition to or separate from the $11,648 in legal fees that he returned?
Separate, Your Honor. I believe that was a forfeiture.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Bittner, following up on Justice Patterson's question, he admitted at the plea colloquy to deliberately deceiving the lenders about what was happening with the proceeds.
Yes.
And that was, I take it, because they wouldn't have dispersed the funds had they known the truth.
I believe his allocation included the fact that he knew they were relying upon what he was stating in those. Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
So you said earlier that the homeowners were aware, and I wanted you to explain what it is they were aware and how they were aware.
Yes. I'll get into it subsequently, but the record reflects, and where that comes from, the record, I believe, is Mr. Whipple's pre-sentencing memorandum, because there's not an extensive record here. I think we can all see that. The Office of Attorney Ethics was invited to commit to conduct an investigation by the DRB, and they didn't. So the record really reflects what was submitted to Judge Karashi in connection with the criminal proceeding. The information so there was two HUD-1s, okay? We talked about the one HUD-1 that was false, and that was the HUD-1 that was sent to the lender. There's no question about that, and Mr. Egan has pled to that. The other HUD-1 showed the actual disbursement, showed the money as it was actually dispersed going out to the contractors. That HUD-1 was signed by the homeowners. And the existence of that HUD-1, sure, the lender was deceived, absolutely. But the evidence as submitted at the sentencing shows that the homeowners weren't. Now, they ultimately were.
Was there a discussion that took place, or was it just a signature on the bottom of a HUD-1?
I don't think there's anything in the record, Judge. I'd love to tell you there was a discussion, but I don't think there's anything in the record that would support me answering that question. Yes, it was. It was indicated in the defense counsel's pre-sentence memorandum of, and it's cited in our brief, the two HUD-1s, and that the one showing the real distributions was signed by the home.
So the sole basis for the representation of the court that the homeowners were aware is that they were given a sheet of paper which they signed. And there's, I should say differently, their signature appears on the bottom of the HUD-1.
Yeah, well, the basis for what's submitted in my brief is what the record reflects from the briefing in the federal court. But yes, that's, I don't have any other evidence to show you from the record here, Your Honor, that the homeowners knew. But that was what was submitted and accepted by the sentencing court, that the fraud that Mr. Puccio and Peralta, right, they're in on the whole thing. They defrauded the homeowners. What Mr. Egan was ultimately charged with and pled to was a fraud on the lender themselves. I think the procedural history of the ethics proceedings, I just want to mention it. There's been some questions already. But as soon as Mr. Egan pled guilty, he immediately notified the Office of Attorney Ethics. He was temporarily suspended, and he's cooperated ever since. He's been suspended we're close to 2 years now. It's been suspended since February of 2022. In October of 2022, the Office of Attorney Ethics files their first motion for final discipline. And the initial motion filed by the Office of Attorney Ethics, again, based on this exact record, did not invoke the principles of Holland Honor. It did not request disbarment. It sought an 18-month to two-year suspension. And on January 23rd, after we'd had oral argument before the Disciplinary Review Board, the board denied the OEE's motion and remanded the matter, quote, for quote, an investigation of whether respondent violated RPC's 1.15A and the principles of Wilson and Holland Honor, in addition to any other RPCs, end quote. The OEE didn't conduct any further investigation, but on their second bite of the apple, on this exact same record, even though they had previously requested an 18-month to two-year suspension, the OEE argued that, quote, disbarment is the invariable and proper result. And as we know here, the DRB ultimately filed an opinion with a unanimous recommendation for disbarment. And I'll speak, hopefully, if I have the opportunity, about the DRB opinion in a little more detail. But as counsel for the respondent, I'm compelled to point out that it respectfully rests on contradictions, and it ignored many of the arguments that we had presented. And instead, what the DRB did is it conducted a results-driven analysis by explaining, and I'm quoting, Niehammann was decided in 2014, following which in our 2017 decision in Soriano, and in our 2021 decision in hand, we modified our view of similar fact patterns involving attorneys who, while serving as escrow agents, knowingly disbursed funds in violation of lenders' closing instructions. Modified our view. Holland Honor, this court's decision that addressed escrow liability, was decided in 1985. And I think it's important to point out that this sanction of disbarment was not one that the OAE itself sought or appreciated in their first motion for final discipline. And that fact is perhaps the best support for the proposition that disbarment here is totally unfair and not in line with precedent. I mean, think about it. The Office of Attorney Ethics, the entity that's whole charge concerns enforcing the RPCs, didn't argue initially that disbarment was required. In fact, didn't even cite the Holland Honor case in its brief. And respectfully, that should be concerning, I believe, for the court, because there is a dissonance here. The Holland Honor precedent has simply not been followed or applied evenly. And I think that fact is manifest when the Office of Attorney Ethics didn't even intend to invoke it originally. In terms of the legal arguments that we've presented, we've really presented three legal arguments to support the proposition that the conduct at issue here should not trigger disbarment. And I'd like to go, given the stakes, I'd like to go through those very briefly. Our first argument really involves Hand. Hand was the 2021 decision under which the DRB relied for its recommendation for disbarment. We believe and have submitted that the retroactive application of Hand is inappropriate. And respectfully, it would be fundamentally unjust and inequitable for the court to apply a decision reached in 2021 to conduct that occurred between 2007 and 2010, when the law clearly did not require disbarment. And there's precedent for our urging the court to not give this retroactive application and to give Hand prospective application. This court has held that it will not apply decisions retroactively when considerations of fairness and justice related to surprise and prejudice counsel otherwise. And that was this court's decision in Selective Insurance versus Rothman in 2012. Courts also held that a judgment can be limited to prospective application when retroactive application would produce substantial inequitable results. Again, that was this court in Velez versus Jersey City in 2004. Here, the record in this case really presents the court with undisputed facts demonstrating that a retroactive application of hand would be unfair, prejudicial, and could, indeed would, produce a substantial inequitable result. And again, here, the conduct occurred between 2007 and 2010. When the conspiracy came to light, when Mr. Egan began cooperating, Niehm and the entire line of cases that preceded it, Gensip, Kaminsky, Ansetti, Galler, Froling, Cohorzian, those were the disciplinary standards that applied to this conduct, and disbarment was not on the table. In effect, if the court were to accept the DRB's recommendation of disbarment here, grounded upon its 2021 decision in hand, Mr. Egan would have his career ended because he made the morally correct decision to cooperate with the United States Attorney's Office in its investigation. It's not Mr. Egan's fault that the investigation, the indictments, the subsequent convictions took more than 6 years to come to fruition, but it was his cooperation that made it so, including for the homeowners to realize a substantial level of compensation already. In short, the retroactive application, we believe, of hand to this case would produce an incalculable injustice, and the existing precedent, both in Selective and Velez, really supports a prospective application of that holding. On the flip side, even if we were to apply hand retroactively, I would submit to the court that hand is so factually distinguishable from this case that it doesn't, even its retroactive application doesn't mandate disbarment. In hand, the respondent had significant prior ethics history. She had an admonishment in 2010. She had another one in 2015. She was temporarily suspended in 2015, and she had a prior conviction for tax evasion. Also, Hand was in on the conspiracy, the whole conspiracy, which is different than our case. She also didn't accept responsibility or cooperate. She fought it all the way. Mr. Egan did the opposite. And the DRB, when it recommended disbarment to this court, pointed to her, quote, cumulative criminal history. And this court, in its order granting that disbarment in hand, premised it upon, quote, the totality of the circumstances, end quote. So I would submit to the court that even if hand were to be given its retroactive application, there's a separate standalone basis for the disbarment finding in hand that doesn't mandate the same finding here. Two more subparts of our argument that the conduct at issue here should not trigger disbarment. The next one's Niehm. And Niehm was a case that was decided by this court in 2014. Now, Mr. Niehm, the respondent there, he had a prior ethics history. He had a 2010 admonition for negligent misappropriation of escrow funds. But other than that variance, which actually weighs in Mr. Egan's favor here, because he doesn't have a prior ethics history, the facts of Niehm couldn't be more similar. The conduct occurred in an overlapping time period. In Niehm, it was 2005 till 2007. In Niehm, the respondent prepared HUD ones, which contained inaccurate information upon which the lenders relied, same as here. And here's the quote from Niehm. After the lenders wired the loan proceeds into respondent's trust account, he dispersed them in accordance with the loan officer's instructions rather than as represented on the HUD ones, end quote. That's exactly the same conduct as here. It's exactly the same. Niehm pled guilty to a one-count indictment, same as here, and received a sentence of probation and restitution, same as here. Yet the DRB, when it analyzed Niehammann back in 2014, rejected Hollandaar on the same set of facts and specifically found that respondent did not misappropriate any of the funds for either his or another's benefit. Niehammann is quite literally the same case, and Mr. Niehammann received a 3-month suspension. Respectfully, it's logically impossible to reconcile the outcome in Niehammann, a 3-month suspension, with the DRB recommendation that Mr. Egan's career should be brought to an end. It's just impossible. Finally, the third reason, and the last of our legal argument, is that to support the fact that the conduct at issue should not trigger disbarment, centers around this court's recent determination in Gendel. Now, Gendel was a matter that came before the court less than 3 months ago in November. And the respondent in Gendel found her way before the Supreme Court actually for two separate reasons. The first reason was that she stole money from the state government and the taxpayers by fraudulently obtaining disaster relief funds after Superstorm Sandy. That resulted in state criminal charges against her for 2 counts of third degree theft, I believe, and 1 count of false swearing. She never reported those charges to the OAA. Second reason Gendel found herself before the court was that an audit of her trust account found that she had systematically misappropriated over $66,000 from her clients over the course of at least 138 known real estate transactions between 2011 and 2015. She did so by signing false HUD ones, which misrepresented the cost of certain expenses such as surveyors, title fees, overnight fees, et cetera. And after preparing and signing those false HUD ones, upon which she knew the lenders would rely, Gendel thereafter dispersed excess and unearned funds to herself without the consent of the parties to the transaction. Now, if that sounds familiar, that's exactly what the DRB defined Hollandaar as in Mr. Egan's matter. They said Hollandaar thus stands for the proposition that an attorney who uses escrow funds either for attorney's benefit or the benefit of another without obtaining the consent of the parties to the escrow agreement will be guilty of knowing misappropriation and will face the Wilson disbarment rule. This is precisely what Gendel did. It's precisely what she did. A documented 138 times. This was not her money to take. Those HUD ones were false, and the parties to those 138 transactions never consented to her taking monies to which she wasn't entitled. She did this for personal gain, completely different than Mr. Egan, and deprived the clients of more than $66,000. Yet a citation to Hollandaar can be found literally nowhere in the DRB's 90-page opinion. And ultimately, 3 months ago, the respondent in Gendel appeared before the court and received a 1-year suspension. So respectfully, there is a dissonance here and an inequity between the outcome in Gendel and the DRB's recommendation here, which simply just can't be ignored. Hollandaar has not been applied consistently and sometimes inexplicably, as in Gendel, not at all, even when the conduct at issue meets the public, the published definition. So most respectfully, as I conclude my legal argument, when it comes to the ultimate sanction that this court can mete out, disbarment, my client and the members of the bar as a whole are deserving of consistency and servitude because the stakes simply can't be any higher than this. And I think we've laid out a reasonable and compelling arguments here. First, hand should not be applied retroactively. And even if it is, it's distinguishable. Two, Niehammann should dictate the outcome here. And three, given the finding and the outcome in Gendel, it can't be reconciled with the DRB's recommendation of disbarment. Will the court allow me? I know it depends on the definition under Hollandaar, but I would like to just briefly highlight the mitigation that's present here and set forth in my brief. Briefly, if with the court's permission.
Go right ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. The undisputed mitigating facts here are actually overwhelming, all supporting, I believe, this man's fitness and character to continue in a career as a lawyer. And I'd like to go through them. In terms of good reputation and character, the court has in the record 21 letters from friends, family, colleagues, members of Mr. Egan's community, all attesting to his character. And I think those letters, one of the things that was striking to me as I watched the criminal aspect of this unfold was how that community support was moving to both the judge and to the United States attorney. Judge Karashi commented, "I meant what I said before when I read through all the submissions and all the letters from your community, from your family, from the attorneys that have worked with you, from clients. And I think it's rare to have a defendant in this court, Mr. Egan, like yourself, somebody who I actually think is a good person that made a mistake." And the U.S. attorney, his name was Kevin DeGregory. He's a career Justice Department prosecutor, and he's actually from Washington. He works in Washington. This is what he had to say. "I've read through all the letters in the package that Mr. Whipple presented, and I have been doing this for a long time. Most of my career has been as a prosecutor, and I have never seen anything, any show of support like what I saw. And I believe that Mr. Egan's acceptance of responsibility, of the mantle of responsibility for what he had done, is so consistent with the character that it shines through in these letters." Continuing briefly with the mitigation, Mr. Egan has no, it's undisputed, he has no prior disciplinary history. I'd ask the court to contrast that with Nihaman, who did have an admonition and got 3 months on the same set of facts. And Soriano, who that was a 2017 decision where the DRB made a recommendation for disbarment in a similar case. The court did not accept that recommendation and gave Mr. Soriano a 2-year suspension. Mr. Soriano had a prior ethics history. He had a reprimand in 2004 and a censure in 2011. So he was essentially a 3-time offender when he came before the court, which should be contrasted with Mr. Egan. Another mitigating factor is the ready admission of wrongdoing. And the record is just not in dispute here. Once Mr. Egan learned of this conspiracy, he admitted his role and he set out to make things right. Again, Mr. Gregory, the U.S. attorney, says, quote, "And I want to stop here and say that one of the things that was impressive to me is that Mr. Egan owned this. He did not take an opportunity to say, well, this employee of mine or that employee of mine is the one who made the mistake or who did wrong. He just owned it from the beginning, and that shows through the proffers." That should be contrasted with the respondent in hand who didn't admit any wrongdoing, as well as the respondent in Gendel that just came before the court. The DRB pointed out when it came to ready admission of wrongdoing that the respondent in Gendel took, quote, "took no responsibility for her actions and instead insisted she engaged in misconduct because everyone else was doing it." That respondent in Gendel also blamed government employees and her own counsel for her unethical conduct. Service to the community, I'm not gonna belabor the oral argument. The record shows that Mr. Egan and his family have a longstanding commitment to public service. I want to touch on two last things. Circumstances showing little likelihood of repeat offenses. There's nothing in this record that shows that there's any chance that Mr. Egan is a danger to the public or that this could ever happen again. I couldn't say it better than Judge Karashi said it, and I'm sorry to keep quoting him, but it's the record and that's what it is on a motion for final discipline. But I tell you, on this aspect, this is what Judge Karashi had to say. "And I will tell you that I don't know what the status of your law license is going to be after this case, Mr. Egan, but I hope they'll consider whether you might still have a future as a lawyer one day. I don't think necessarily your involvement in this case should prohibit you from practicing law. That's not a decision for this court. It's not a decision for me, but I will tell you based upon my review of this case, based upon my experience as a federal prosecutor, a criminal defense attorney who did white collar criminal defense in federal court, and as a former magistrate judge and now as a district judge, I think there's hope for you to represent clients in the future. And I hope that your ethics counsel will be able to do what he needs to do to at least allow you maybe an opportunity in the future to represent clients and continue your practice of law. The last thing I'll touch on is that this misconduct there was not for personal gain. There's absolutely no evidence is to the contrary. Mr. Egan didn't know about the larger conspiracy and he didn't profit from it. And that should definitely be contrasted with Ms. Gindel, who came before the court 3 months ago, who everything she did to enrich herself. There's $66,000 that went to her that wasn't hers. So I would ask that that mitigating factor be considered in contrast. In closing, I know that this was an extensive colloquy for me, and I want to thank the court for its time and attention today, as I know this was lengthy. And I just want to say, for what it's worth, I believe truly that this is a good man. He's not just a client, but over all these years where we've been helping him, he's become a friend. He made a terrible mistake, and there's absolutely no question about that. But I hope that the court will consider, based upon the legal arguments we've presented and the substantial mitigation, I hope the court will consider giving him a second chance to practice law. He's not going to let you down, and I'm confident of that. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Mitter. Mr. Egan, you have not one but two fine attorneys with you. Would you like a minute to consult with them before deciding whether you want to address the court? You can just turn your mic off.
He's ready to proceed, Your Honor. I'm going to just switch seats with him.
Perfect. Thank you.
Would you unmute it, Pat?
Please go ahead, Mr.
Oh, can you hear me? Thank you.
Yes, please go ahead. Right.
Thank you for your time. First, I just would like to say, I know I'm completely responsible for the judgment I used over 10 years ago. I've admitted and accepted that from day one. From the moment I realized what occurred in my office, I tried to do everything I could to make amends. From fully cooperating, however necessary, and offering to pay back the homeowners every penny that was stolen from them under my watch. The one thing I'm sure of, though, is I never had any intent to harm anyone, whether it be the lender or the homeowner victims. It's just not my nature. I truly believe what we're doing was simply following the wishes of the homeowners by making payments directly to builders for work on their homes. I had no knowledge of any fraud being committed by these builders. And I made sure, you know, we made sure that there were authorizations from the homeowners to make the payments. But that being said, as the court considers my punishment and my future, I would just like to say that while I know I deserve to be punished or disciplined for my actions, I can assure this court that no matter what is decided, nothing will compare to what I've gone through for the past 10 years. Not a day goes by where I do not think about what I have done and the people I have hurt and what my future will hold. It has been all consuming. It's the first thing I think about when I wake up, and the last thing I think about before I go to bed every day for 10 years. Excuse me, I'm sorry. My actions have cost me my law practice, my reputation, my family's trust and respect, and ruined me financially. This has been the hardest time of my life, and I wouldn't wish it upon anyone. This is the one thing that has kept me going through this ordeal is the prospect of me getting to practice law again and redeeming myself to my friends, colleagues, clients, and most importantly, my family. I bring this up in hopes that you will consider this as you decide this matter and decide my future. I know I'm a very good attorney and an even better person. What I did is not who I am. I am a caring, considerate, generous person who always tries to help anyone in need whenever I can. And if I had any inclination that people were getting hurt through the closings being done in my office, I never would have allowed these deals to close, because that is the exact opposite of who I am and what I believe in. In fact, once I realized what had occurred with these files, I immediately changed many things in my office, including to stop handling bank closings altogether, slowing down our volume. I hired an office manager and a CPA to handle the bookkeeping and trust accounting. I then ran my practice for an additional 8 years under these new guidelines with zero ethics complaints, which should help this court feel confident that by allowing me to practice again, there is no danger to the public. Lastly, I'm sure you have reviewed the various letters, which truly show the type of person I am and outlines the life I try to lead. And I hope you will take that into consideration as you decide my fate. I have learned so much about myself and who I want to be going forward that I know if this court permits me to practice again, I will exceed all expectations and be a tremendous advocate for all future clients. Thank you very much.
Mr. Minder, I accept. If you could please stay there. Oh, no, I have a few questions I'd like to ask you. And I'll start out by saying that I accept that you feel remorseful over what's happened here. Our responsibility, as you noted, is to make sure that we protect the public. Tell us what it is that you thought you were accomplishing by directing the funds to the co-defendants instead of to your elderly clients.
I felt that we were doing what the homeowner was asking us to do it, and I wasn't considering that the client was actually the lender versus the homeowner who was actually paying us the fee. So
you said what you felt the homeowner wanted. Did the homeowners ask you to send this money?
Well, they authorized it. Absolutely. They knew where it was going. And again, I was running a high volume practice with multiple paralegals. So I personally didn't work on these files. I mean, we were doing 100 to 200 closings a month at that point in time.
And how did they know the money was going to the co-defendants?
Well, because we would have had the policy was we had to have authorization for any disbursements that were made out of the trust account. So we dispersed according to the HUD one that the homeowner signed paying the builder. We never had a client call going, where's my money? The money went to the builder and they clearly acknowledged because they signed off and we dispersed it without an issue.
So the authorization was them signing the false HUD one?
Correct.
Did each of them sign two HUD ones, a correct yes. one and a false one?
Correct.
And did you go over with them what it is these HUD ones called for?
So I personally never met any of these clients. We were doing settlement. Notaries were sent to all the homes. I never met any of these clients. I didn't handle the closings personally. They were done in home with various notaries that we would contract with.
So a notary went with a document and they signed the document in front of that notary and then it came back to you?
Came back to our office, to my paralegal, who then processed the closings, correct.
So nobody explained to them that these monies were supposed to go directly to them, that that's what the bank required. You just gave them a piece of paper, two pieces of paper that conflicted and had them sign both?
I'm not sure what was explained at the table because I wasn't at the table.
Well, who was at the table? Who was
at the table? The notary.
The notary didn't. It's hard to imagine that the notary explained the terms of the document.
No, but my paralegals would also talk to the clients in advance, but I would not want to say specifically what they told these clients because my office would set the closing up through my paralegal.
Were the clients told that the lenders would not lend this money if you gave them, if you were going to give the money over to the co-defendants?
Well, the only reason we wouldn't have done it without authorization of the homeowner, I guess, is the point.
And the sole authorization that you're telling us you're aware of is the fact that they signed a false HUD one And a notary witness their signature.
Correct.
I'm assuming that it's correct that they were not told. They were actually participating in deceiving the lenders by signing a false HUD one.
I would say you're correct on that. Absolutely.
Is it fair to say that without them even realizing it, they were enlisted in defrauding the bank, in deceiving the bank?
I guess I never thought of it that way, but I can't argue with you. They did sign the one that went to the bank, but yeah.
How old were your clients?
They were elderly.
Can you put a number to that?
I mean, I would assume over 60.
You don't know how old they were?
Not each one, no, not specifically. But they were definitely older because they're reverse mortgages. So there's an age restriction on those mortgages.
What's the age restriction?
I think it was 62.
That you couldn't be older than 62?
No, you had to be at least 62.
Were any of them older than 70 or 80?
I honestly do not know that.
The stipulation that they were vulnerable victims was based on what?
Well, that they were elderly.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Egan, I know you mentioned that you weren't there at the point at which these homeowners were signing the documents and that you've never met them, but I just want to be clear, you were aware that there were two HUD ones being generated, one that was going to be false and one that was going to be accurate, with the false one going to the lenders.
Yes, absolutely. That's what I admitted to, 100%.
So you were aware of that?
Yes.
Is it fair to say that but for these co-conspirator supposed contractors leaving, that the idea would have been for them to actually do work and you're just getting money from the lender that you would not have otherwise been able to obtain?
Well, could you repeat that? I'm not sure I followed it.
I'm trying to figure out if the idea was that there was work that was supposed to be done for these clients.
Absolutely. I believe we actually would have believed the work was done, because without the work being done, the house wouldn't appraise enough for the loan.
But did I understand the record that at some point these co-conspirators took off with the money? They left without finishing the work and without returning the money.
That's my understanding, correct.
So your understanding of this whole thing was that you were getting money from the lender that you would not have otherwise been able to get for these clients, but you expected that work was going to be done for each of them.
Correct. I believe we actually expected the work was done, because if the work wasn't done, you know, I mean, it's not uncommon to do work on your house, do a refinance, pull out the money now that the house has higher value, and pay the builder. So the fact that they were able to get approved for the loans to pull the cash out, to me, implies the work's done. The problem here, apparently, though, was that they actually had a crooked appraiser who was submitting false appraisals to inflate the value. So they were able to pull the money out before the work was done, which is what I learned after, as I went through all my cooperations with the FBI.
How did these clients come to you? Did they come through the appraiser, through the contractors? Did you
get them yourself? Mortgage brokers. Mortgage. We did a lot. We referred a lot of closings from various mortgage companies throughout the state.
Other questions, anyone?
Forgive my ignorance, Mr. Minter, but ordinarily on any mortgage, if there's work being done to make sure that the property is worth what the bank is putting out, that work would be done before the closing. And at closing, you would have bills, receipts, whatever, and money would be paid out of the funds to the contractors with a net check going to the mortgagor.
Correct. And that's what happened. We thought happened here, because we received an invoice that we paid from the contractor.
Is there a reason why there was not simply one HUD form? What is with this configuration? I understand the fraud that's going on, but certainly from your perspective or your paralegal's perspectives, it could have looked completely kosher, clean, lawful, as we could have documented at the time of closing.
They could have done one HUD and had the client sign a separate piece of paper, potentially to pay a builder or sign an invoice. Absolutely, it could have been. As I look back, a million things could have been different 15 years ago when we were doing this.
But yet these guys concocted this scheme that required all of these additional HUD, the additional HUD ones that were in unto themselves fraudulent to pull off this scheme. In other words, I guess what I'm getting to is kind of what Attorney Ethics is saying, that if somebody sees that happening and doesn't simply tear one up and say, listen, we'll resolve all this and close it, they've got to know somebody's taking money out of somebody's pocket. Is there a reason why that didn't register with anybody?
I can only say, you know, because I can blame it on negligence of me not watching my staff. I could blame it on multiple paralegals. I could blame it on doing too much volume. I could blame it on, I wish I had a better answer.
But you were aware that there were two, again, you were aware that there were two HUD ones being submitted, one being a false one. So I guess Justice Solomon asked, generally, shouldn't there have been red flags and alarms going off for someone? I mean, directly, shouldn't the red flags have been going off for you, considering you knew that there were two HUD ones being submitted, including one that was false, a fraud on the lender?
When I look back,
there has to be something going on that's not completely standard, right? When you're submitting false documentation to a government agency.
Well, we were submitting to the lender.
Well, sometimes to the lender.
Correct. No, I can't disagree. I wish I had an answer, and I wish I picked up on it, and I wish I, believe me, I wish I could go back in time and fix this, because I definitely would. I mean, I wish I had an answer for that.
Any other questions, anyone? Mr. Egan, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, Pat, you good.
Thank you.
No, I'll give the chair back to the boss. Thank you.
I think we're done unless the boss insists that he wants to add something. I think we're...
No, thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advice.